Tonight's talk is on prison, what a prison is, the penal system itself, specifically the California penal system, which is fortunately all I've ever had to encounter, the different kinds of institutions within the California penal system, release and parole boards, guards, wardens, your average inmate, your special inmate. What does prison do? What does it hurt? Does it help? I'm going to share what typical experiences at Santa Rita, which is where I spent a year of my life behind bars at, what isolation was like, what recreation was like, the problems with homosexuality, mental outlooks, ideas of personal beliefs that I have on prison reform. Also, at that time, I'm going to ask for other people to get involved. I'm going to go into a little bit of detail about how I've stayed out of prison, but the fact that I stayed out of prison was not directly because of prison. I'm going to go into why people go back, what I believe is probably the major three things. Now, at first, it'll be a while before I have some questions to go through here, because first I want to start off as to what the prison system is, as we have in the United States today. The prison system that we have today in the United States is a result of, probably 2,000 or 3,000 years of mankind, where for 2,000 or 3,000 years we've said, well, if somebody breaks the law, we'll put them behind bars. It wasn't always like that because, the Philippines, they had their manual strangulations. The Arabs had their eye for an eye, their tooth for the tooth. Through the years, it's been off and on different. The medieval times, it was the dungeons with the torture chambers. The thing that's really remarkable about prison is that anything that anybody has ever done in all through history, whether it be war or in peace, there's been somebody that's gone to prison for it. At some time in history, somebody's gone to prison for it. Somebody's gone to prison for spitting on a sidewalk. Somebody's gone to prison for saying something bad about a queen. Somebody's gone to prison for typical things like murder and extortion, robbery. But the thing about it is, everything that anybody's ever done at one time through history, somebody has gone to prison for it. A prison system is more than just gray walls and steel bars. A prison system is, it's probably one of the things in the United States that most people never think about, because you're never going to tangle with it. You're never going to cross it. Maybe if you're lucky, you'll forget to pay a parking ticket. You might get to spend overnight in the county jail or the city jail, which is no big thing. I guess to some people it is, but it's not really all that bad. You might get picked up for drunk driving, or a friend of yours might get picked up for drunk driving, and you might see him get bailed out, or you might have to go through a bail bondsman. The idea of a city jail is completely different than that of a state prison system. The way the prison system's set up in the United States, the prison system in the United States is an institution that's designed to house various kinds of people. We have maximum security, we have medium maximum, minimum maximum, we have prisons for the criminally insane, and we have the drug rehabilitation, which is a new development within the last 10 to 12 years. California leads the way in what they call CRC, which is California Rehabilitation Center, which is for victimless crime, because these people are drug abusers. So actually, they are the victim of their own crimes. That's the way California looks at it. So they have set up what is known as CRC in King County, which is really strange, because it's only about 90 miles away from maximum security. That's where places like San Quentin, Vacaville, in prison term, it's what they call the arena. Medium maximum and mini maximum are the gladiator school. This is the arena. This is where you don't want to go. Four walls, 200 feet tall, solid concrete, a place where the fog is right, built right on the edge of San Francisco Bay, San Quentin, which is what I'm talking about. In the morning, you freeze from the fogs that come in, and during the day, you sweat from the heat that comes off the bay. And it's always smoggy. It's very dirty. When you first look at it, you think it was almost a a major nuclear power plant or something, the way everything's all surrounded. As far as you can see, that's where for 10 years recently, well, as late as last winter, where they discovered that tunnel that people had been digging for 10 years. It took them 10 years to discover a tunnel. And the thing that was really remarkable was that the people that were digging this tunnel originally got the idea to dig the tunnel off of somebody that wrote a book about how to escape from San Quentin over 20 years ago. And so they had 10 years to spend to dig a tunnel, and they finally got caught. But you know, that's the, that you're okay. Now, how do you dig a tunnel for 10 years without nobody ever finding out about it? Where do you hide dirt that you've been digging a tunnel for 10 years? You know, people like that kind of lead you to the conclusion of one thing, that the criminals that are in maximum security are not your typical Joe Friday off the street. These guys are very intelligent people. They're also very dangerous people. That's why they're in San Quentin. The average life, let me see, 14% of the people that go to San Quentin are dead within the first 6 to 8 months that they get to San Quentin due to violence. Most of the people that are in, they have no minimum security in San Quentin. All they have is medium security and maximum security. Most people there are, over the years, it's been evolutionized to the point of where it's straight hardcore criminals. You're habitual criminal. You're incorrigible person, as they're classified as. People that they say, well, we don't have no hopes for these people. Typical day in San Quentin starts off when they open the doors at 6:30. And at 6:30, when those doors open, from the people I've talked to in San Quentin, it's like you're at your door guarding yourself, because if you don't, somebody's going to come in and kill you. That's how fast it is. Very violent place. Then you have your medium mass, which is Folsom, which is what I guess is what made Johnny Cash famous. Folsom Prison is what they call medium max, because it's your second time offenders, your first stage of your habitual criminals on their way to max. People that haven't committed murder, but they're going to real quick. And then we have minimum maximum, all right? Minimum maximum is Santa Rita and Chino. Santa Rita is where I was. It's your, for like your first time offender, okay? I was sentenced to 1 year for the charge of assault with intent to kill. Most of the people that I was in there before were anywhere from pickpocketing for their 20th bust to people that had gone through the system this way, that were on their way out of the system to parole, that had been in San Quentin for like murder, and then they were in max. Okay, Santa Rita had three different kinds of inmates. You had minimum security, which was no big deal. Anybody could escape from minimum security. But if you escape from a minimum security facility, which is state parole, one step above your county jail, all right? County jail is probation. State parole is what comes out of here. This is your lowest level of state parole. If you would escape, that means that you automatically qualify for San Quentin. So it's kind of like an added thing for most people not to escape from minimum security. Then you had your medium security, and then you had your murder max. Murder max was called murder max because that's where all your people from San Quentin came from and went to murder max first. It was on the third floor. Then you have Atascadero Men's Colony near Monterey, California. That's where 95% of your sex offenders are going to go, your child molesters, your continuous rapists, real sickies. And then you have Vacaville. Vacaville is not very far from San Quentin. It's another medical rehabilitation center, only it's for what they call the criminally insane, people like Charles Manson. That's where Charles Manson is right now, is at Vacaville, because they say that he's criminally insane, he's never going to get paroled, so we'll just keep him here. Why? I don't know. And then we're back to, like I said before, for drug rehabilitation, California CRC. Now, wait a minute, I've got to check my notes here. All right. Now, the one people that run all this thing, the Penal Administration, which is governed, the head man of the Penal Administration in any state is the governor. Here it's Dixie Lee Ray. I forget who was the governor at the time that I was doing my time. The Penal Administration is where, when you come from the court, they get your case, they review it, And unless the judge, which has got to be a Superior Court judge, do that. Okay, if a Superior Court judge dictates that you're going to go to San Quentin or any of those other places, you will. But most of the times you just get sentenced, all right? So it goes to the penal administration, and if you're a first-time offender, it's almost mandatory you go to Santa Rita or Chino, unless you're on drug charge, in which case you go to CRC. Now, a number of the people at CRC, they get in trouble. So they become too much of a problem, so they send them up to minimum max. So you got a lot of junkies running around there, too. All right? So you got a system that's within the system. Each one feeds itself. People graduate from Atascadero. From Atascadero, they're moved to minimum max. If they haven't gotten killed somewhere along the line, then eventually they'll end up in max, in which case then they got to work their way back. And when they get out of that, well, by that time, the mind's usually gone, so there isn't very much chance. Either that or, you know, they've been probably knifed 20 or 30 times by that time. They've been poisoned. And, well, most of them just aren't going to make it. You never hear about sex offenders getting released. They just don't make it. Let me see. On all these things, you have your parole board, all right? To get out of any of these systems, you have to go back through your penal administration, back through your parole. Okay, so what is a parole? Parole is, okay, they say, we're going to let you out, but here's the conditions you're going to go through. But before you can get to even that stage, you have to go through the parole board, which is convened while you're in prison. You're never told whether or not you're going to go in front of a parole board. Sometimes, if you're lucky, you might get a written notice 6 months in advance that on such and such a date, you're due to go in front of a parole board. What they do at the time that you go in front of a parole board is they review your case, which basically consists of reading what the guards have to say about you. Most of the guards that I knew were pretty honest about the way you related to the rest of the population. As long as you left the guards alone, they pretty much give you a square shot. There were, well, I'll go into that later. Okay, so you go in front of your parole board. Now, who's on a parole board? Anybody that's on a parole board is a political hack. Occasionally, you might have a prison psychologist who's working towards being ahead of some other kind of federal job or a political job or something like that. Most people are certified sociologists, mayors, retired judges, retired chiefs of police that are working up to be assistant mayors or something. But you never have an ex-convict, and you never have somebody that's really trained in penology, which is the study of criminal justice, more or less, within the penal system. It's penology. If that was the case, 95% of the people that go in front of a parole board, you know, they would have the ability to take a lie detector test, sodium pentothal, which is truth serum, anything to find out, you know, if you're really going to try when you get out. Because that's the biggest problem with people that get out of prison, is that they go back, you know. Why they go back is something I'm going to go into later. Okay, now, within all these systems, okay, with every one of these prisons around here. Am I going too fast? Okay. With every one of these prisons around here, you have a warden who's the head, okay? Now, the warden only has to take orders off of one person, and that's the government. He doesn't have to take orders off anybody else. So he's more or less God. He walks around. What he says, it is done. There's no ifs and ors or buts about it. If he goes up there and he tells his guards that they can go ahead and brutalize anybody they want to, they can go ahead and do it. And you know that warden is never going to have to stand up in front of anybody. All right? The warden at minimum max, he was pretty straightforward. He didn't like the idea of the guards beating up on people, but there wasn't nothing he was going to say about it if that's what happened. All right? So your typical guard. Okay, what is a prison guard? A prison guard is one of the lowest paid people that as far as a state employee that there is. He's paid less than your city cop. He's paid less than your fireman. He's stuck in a job that only takes an eighth grade education to get in the first place, which means you barely have to know how to write your name, all right? He's probably, the only thing he's got to look forward to is that if the inmates don't kill him, which could very well happen in places like San Quentin,
If he makes it his 20 years, he gets to retire on a very low pension. So what does he really have for that 20 years? He's got a chance to, if he's a civilian worker, he might make sergeant of the yard, which means that he's the head bull. And to be sergeant of the yard, you have to be literally a goon. You know, you got to be able to stomp anybody that gets in the way, because you got to be the ramrod, because a lot of people in prison don't have they have a tendency not to listen to people that are very small. They're very violent people. So the sergeant of the guard is the head goon. Then you have your officer of the yard. Your officer of the yard is a member of the state sheriff's department. There aren't very, you know, and this causes conflict too, because guards are civilian workers. Then you have your state patrol or your highway patrol or something like that. You know, it's never city, it's never county, it's always state. They're the ones that come in and tell these guards what to do, you know. They're the ones that carry weapons, whereas your typical guard might carry tear gas, although usually all he carries is a club. So the officers are the ones that man the towers with the guns in them, all right? The head of the goon squad, they're the people that a lot of them are trained in police interrogation, and they have a population of people in prison that they can practice all these interrogation techniques that they were taught and trained. I'm not going to say all of them are bad, because they're like everybody else. They're doing the job. They're doing it as best they can. They get mixed up in a system that grinds them under. It grinds everybody under. It doesn't matter who it is. They still get ground. Even the warden, the one guy that's playing God over top of it all, even the governor, they all get ground down by the prison system, because nothing ever changes in prison. It's still dirty. It's still filthy. It's still got disease in it. In our time, we're seeing more changes done for the prison system than probably any prison system ever. I mean, people are finally being able to say, hey, we can do something with these inmates. Most of all, people are realizing that it isn't the outside forces. You know, you can't take an inmate and say, well, we'll guarantee you a job when you get on the outside if you straighten up. They're finding out that if they leave it to the inmate themselves, that they can straighten it out. And I'm going to go into that later. Okay, so we've got our guards, we've got our wardens, we've got our prisons, we've got our governors, we've got our parole boards. Okay, now we've got your typical inmate, all right? Your typical inmate is anywhere between the ages of 18 to probably 47. You don't see very many people in prison over the age of 47. Most are like me, never finished high school, never had any intentions to finish high school. Although there are a lot of them that are very talented, that have had various jobs, bankers, high school principals, your master con artists who are very intelligent, forgers, counterfeiters, the best artists you've ever seen are counterfeiters. But your typical one, I'd say probably 35% of the people that I was in prison with didn't know how to read or write, which is something that most of us take for granted, all right? I was lucky enough to the point where I knew how to read and write, and I was good at writing, so I made a lot of money while I was in prison just by writing letters for people that couldn't read or couldn't write. And if you think it's easy to sit down and write a letter to somebody's wife telling them how much you love them, how much you love your wife, try it sometime, you know? But, you know, you can, and also you can write up writs of habeas corpus for when people are going back for retrial, rescheduling, the different things. Then you get your special inmate. You get your what they call PC, protective custody. Your protective custody person is, like every once in a while, I got talking with John the other night. Every once in a while you get somebody that will take a chainsaw and cut a child up, all right? He's not technically considered a child molester. All right, that's a crime of violence, but it's not child molestation. So they put him in there with you, all right? Okay, people like that, okay, if you think it's bad enough to read about it, just try to imagine what an inmate feels like when he's in prison trying to survive. And they're going to come up with no consideration to you and say, we're going to put this guy in you. Imagine if you're 32 years old, all right, and you have a daughter that's 9 or 10 years old, which was the same age as this guy the same age of this girl that this guy chained open with a chainsaw. All right? Where does that leave you? Okay, I'm going to go in a little while further about the different ways of dealing with things while you're in prison. But that's what a special inmate is. Or a special inmate is somebody that, say, turns into a real snitch once he gets into prison. You know, he cops out on somebody. So they're going to put him, he's going to wear a little blue uniform, he's going to stay down at minimum security where none of the big boys can get a hold of him. He's going to get a chance to pretty much stand around and brag about all the tough things he's done when the people that are in medium security and Murder Max are really going to know what he's like. Okay, I'm going to try to give an idea of how prison goes, all right? What I'm going to say may not sound very nice at times, and I'm going to try not to get very emotionally involved, all right? When you go to prison, you have... The first thing you have to do is you have to establish yourself, all right? On the lowest rung is your rapist, which is, most people call them rapos. Then you have your pickpocket. Nobody likes the pickpocket because that's just chump change. If you're gonna break the law, do it right. I mean, don't waste time about it. Nobody wants to spend time in prison with somebody that's gone and done a crime just to survive. Because you can go out and get a job and survive. $3.50 an hour will give you enough money to survive. So why do you gotta go out and pick somebody's pocket? Then you have, it works on up from small crimes like that to you got your people that were armed robberies. Armed robbers are considered kind of up there because of the fact that it takes nerve to sit there and point a gun in somebody's face and tell them to give me money, you know, because there's still the chance that you're going to pull the trigger and you're going to commit murder, all right? So armed robbers are kind of considered up there. People that do things like extortion, forgery, computer theft, all those people are looked down on because of the fact that, you know, that's something that you don't have to face anybody to do. You know, all you're doing is stealing from a corporation or something like that. Then you have people that were like me, assault with intent to kill. I mean, that's where somebody has intentionally tried to kill somebody, and then right above me was the people that committed murder. All right? So when you come in, you have to establish where you are. All right? Okay, at the time that I went to prison, I was 21 years old. I'd just been back from Vietnam for 2 years. I still wasn't fully recovered from Vietnam at that time, and most people knew instinctively to leave me alone. Within the first 2 days that I was in prison, I got in 3 fights. My 4th day in prison, I spent in isolation because of that 3rd fight, because I got a little bit carried away and I hurt somebody. So after I came back out, I was what they call a solid person, because while I was in the hole, I didn't talk. And my first experience in isolation was like this. Okay, you know, I was originally sentenced to 3 weeks in isolation. During that 3 weeks in isolation, okay, what's isolation? Isolation is a little hole that's just, oh, enough room for you to maybe lay this way and maybe lay that way. It's got a little hole in the floor for you to take your shit in. You get your food in a little brown paper bag 3 times a day that comes in through a little hole in a metal door. 3 times a week they tear gas you just to make sure you're still alive. And if you can come out through that and you're still pretty much together, people consider you to be a pretty solid person. So after 3 weeks I came back out and people pretty much left me alone. A lot of people I know, they didn't quite come out of it that well. As well as I did. They came out, well, it's kind of like, okay, for 3 weeks, you got 24 hours a day to sit, stare at 6 walls. You don't got very much room to walk. You don't even have as much room to walk as I just have back and forth. So you learn not to look at walls, just look at the floor. You learn not to listen. You learn not to sleep, because if you sleep, that you lose all. When you start to sleep, that's when the nightmares come. Then that's when the walls start to close in on you. That's when the guy in the tank next to you starts screaming. And that's the only sound that you might hear is that guy next to you, and you're going nuts. People in isolation have been known to literally completely break their hands off their wrists from banging walls. They've been known to get themselves skull fractures because of banging their heads on walls too hard. It's been known to break them down. People that ordinarily would not have given in to homosexuality, when they come out of isolation, they do it just so they can have the comfort of somebody sitting there and establishing the fact that they're back in reality. Not all people that go to isolation come out with problems. At least I don't think I did. I might have at first, but you see, the one thing that's really great when you come out of isolation is the fact that there's an awful lot of people there that are willing to back you up. If, while you're in isolation, you don't break down and tell the guards everything that you know about everybody else. I'd only been there for 4 days when I first went in, so I didn't know anything about anybody. You know, but believe me, it went through my mind at that time that if I had had something to tell to get me out of that place, I would have. Afterwards, well, if you can go through it once, you can go through it twice. There was a man there at the time that I'd been there that had been in isolation for a year and a half. A year and a half, you know, a shower once every 2 weeks. Most people wouldn't even know what he looked like, you know, after a year and a half, but they knew he was still down there. His big mistake was he attacked a guard. So they'd just keep him down there, and then when the guards didn't have nothing to do, they'd go down there and beat him up. A lot of times people commit suicide in isolation. And then also besides isolation, you have observation. Observation is where if you try to commit suicide, they're going to put you for a couple of days. A psychiatrist is going to come and ask you how you are, and then they're going to send you back out to segregation. People that try to commit suicide while they're in prison are considered losers. They're considered people that aren't going to make it. So like, you know, it's kind of like, to give you a general idea, okay, if you stab a rat and it's in a pack and it starts to bleed, the rest of the rats will attack it. That's the same thing with people that commit suicide. They're considered weaklings, you know. And when you're trying to ride your beef, which is what doing time is, you don't want to have to support somebody else, and you can't. You just can't do it. It'll break you. When you know you're going to be there for a year like me, you just kind of keep your mouth shut, you do your time, and you get out. People that are going to be there for 5 or 10 years, they have it even worse, because for 5 or 10 years, they have to pretty much cut people completely out of their life. Because say they get to know somebody for 4 years, all right, and they got, say, another 3 years to go till they get out. Okay, for 4 years they've known somebody, then that guy gets paroled. So for 4 years they had a friendship. Then that guy's got to sit there and think about, you know, hey, you know, that guy's out on the streets tonight and I'm still here. Maybe that guy didn't do a crime, or did a crime that was worse than what the guy that's still in there did, but he got less time for it. And that's when things start to cave in on you about just how screwed up things are. All right, so you come out and you're in, okay, it starts off, you're in minimum security, which is where they put me when I first came out of isolation. I managed to spend, I guess, probably, 3 or 4 weeks in minimum security before I finally lost it and beat up somebody again, and that was enough grounds. Well, that and the fact that, okay, I'm officially on my report, what happened was, a prison guard walked up to me and he said, put out that cigarette. And by that time I had pretty much enough. And when he told me to put out the cigarette, I told him what I thought of him. And that was enough grounds to have me moved up to medium security. Because at that time they started realizing that I was starting to become a little bit dangerous. Okay, minimum security. When you go to the chow hall, you got to wait in line with 600 other people to go to chow. You got all your wimps, all your weasels, all your losers, all your protective custody people, just people that you don't really like. You sleep in a dormitory, 70 people, with double 70 beds, double bunks, three across in the dorm, split with the wall, and then the same thing on the other side. You woke up at 7:30 in the morning. You can take a shower anytime you want, although there's only hot water for about an hour out of every day. Everywhere you go, there's some kind of sickie running around. There's going to be somebody that's going to be hustling you. Somebody that's going to be going for your cigarettes. If you leave something sitting down, somebody's going to steal it.
after been in there for a while, medium security sounds pretty good, because medium security is where they got those nice 3 to 4 man cells, you know. 3 to 4 man cells where you don't have to put up with 200 or 300 people. So I lost my temper and told this guard what I thought, so I got moved up to medium security. As I was walking into the cell, the first thing that happened when I walked into the cell was somebody hit me right between the eyes with a steel bar, okay? And it was kind of like, you're at the point of where it's time to reestablish where you stand. So the guards, and this is the greatest thing about medium security, this might sound kind of cruel, but you know, when somebody hits you and you're under a situation like that, your best chance is to release the tension, because if you don't, it's tension like that that breaks you. So the guard was good enough to close the door behind me after this guy hit me, and we had a chance to settle it right then and there, which was good because we got to be pretty good friends after that. Okay, medium security, you got a very small cell, you got bed bunks, at three bunks that fold out from the wall. The bottom bunk is maybe this far off the ground. You have this much space, 17 inches apiece between the bunks. That's what you're allocated. You have one toilet. You have to put in your request for toilet paper 2 weeks in advance if you're going to get it. You have one desk to be also used as a place to eat with four chairs around it, little round things like this connected to the floor that you can't pull up. You have a mirror, which is a piece of stainless steel on the wall with something around it. You're allowed library every day of the week. You don't have to put up with the crap of everybody else. Then it's only maybe 150 people to go to meals. The food's a little bit better, not much, but a little bit better. And plus you get a chance to every once in a while talk with the boys up on Murder Max. You get a chance to take a shower twice a week in peace and privacy. The only thing you get to watch you is a guard, which is no big deal. 2 hours a day, you're allowed out in the exercise yard. The exercise yard is where everybody goes to release all their tension. Everybody, they release 50 cells at one time to go out there out of medium security. They open the door, everybody goes down there, they close the door, and for the first, probably 4 or 5 minutes, everybody just kind of slugs it out just to work some energy off. Then you get around to playing basketball, or you can play handball or whatever else you can get into. Some people end up getting knifed out there, people that got beefs with other people that can't learn to keep their mouth shut and leave other people alone. Every once in a while they let the people down from Murder Max come down, and that's always great because, you know, they're, believe it or not, those people up on Murder Max aren't that bad of people. They're got to be one of the most honest people I've ever met. I mean, you can't throw no more crap at those people, because they've had it thrown at them, some of them for over 25 years of their lifetime. All right, I'm 26. It's hard for me to imagine spending 25 years of my life in a prison. But those people are very straightforward and honest. But at the same time, you have to remember when you're dealing with them that they're very dangerous people. You have to kind of take it with the thought of which is more dangerous. A dog that growls before it bites, or a dog that never growls before it bites. Because if those people are going to get you, if you make them angry in some way or another, they'll kill you. And the thing about it is they're so good at it that they'll kill you and they'll never get caught. So you got that. For other forms of recreation, you have woodshop, or you can go down and visit people in other cells. You have there's a TV besides two cells, and that's for all 6 to 8 people to watch for the rest of the day. The air is a little bit cleaner, the ground's a little bit cleaner. They allow the inmates all the soap that they want to clean their cells with, which is something that minimum security, the filth in minimum security is enough to kill you. I got crabs 4 times while I was in minimum security, just from the bed I slept in. I never once got it the whole time I was in medium security. Now, there's a lot of things that can happen in medium security. People in medium security don't have to take crap off of anybody else. That's why they're in medium security. When a guard gives you crap in medium security, you can push a locker off the second tier while he's walking down below you. That's the most common way to get a guard that gives you a hard time. So they pretty much leave you alone. All they just
ask you to do is, you know, get up when you're supposed to, go to your meals if they call you to come and get them. Your day starts in medium security at 4:30. And at 4:30, you have about 200 steel doors that open at once electronically. And all of them open, and then they all stop. And it echoes all around the concrete building, just like that. You think the whole earth came to an end. If you're asleep, you wake up very quick. It's a sound that nobody can sleep through. And from that time until 7:30, you have to go to eat, which is a very relaxed breakfast. You can sit around, you can have all the coffee you want to drink, which is something that you can't get in minimum security. You got a chance to wake up, look around you, realize where you are, then go back to your cell, let the door get closed, watch TV, except for when you go to the recreation yard. If you stay out of trouble, you can stay out of isolation. And in medium security, you got a pretty good chance to make it, all right? So, comes the day that you go in front of your parole board where, well, okay, one of the things about prison is the fact that you never think about the time that you're spending, all right? You never think about the time that you're spending because if you do, that's going to hurt. You know, you start thinking, wow, I've been in here 45 days, and, you know, it just seems like it's choking you to death that you've been in there 45 days, that you've got so many more days to do, so you block it out. Then one day, all of a sudden, you're in front of a parole board, and you're sitting there going, have I been here 6 months already? It doesn't seem like it, but you're in front of a parole board, and they're saying, yeah, we're going to parole you on such and such a date. So you just, well, okay, big deal. As long as you don't pick up any additional beefs, you can go. So you get to the point comes a day that suddenly they wake you up, all right? It's 2:30 in the morning. Why is this bull waking me up? So you get out of the cell, he's telling you to roll your gear up. You never think about it. next thing I know, I'm walking downstairs. I got my gear rolled up, still half asleep, trying to figure out what's going on. And all of a sudden, it dawns on me. This is the day I'm getting out of prison. This is the day I'm getting out. I made it. I'm getting out of prison. It's not quite that simple, though, because as I'm going down to the first, well, as I'm leaving the tier, which is where medium security is, there was this black inmate from Murder Max, a trustee doing trustee duty, and he's mopping the floor. The guard, there's one more metal cage gate. That's all I got to do to go out. And then they're just going to process me out, and, you know, in a couple hours I'm going to be free. This guy walks right through that cage and closes the door behind him. You know, and I'm sitting here going, right about that time, alarms are going off in my head. This has got to be a setup. The next thing I know, this black inmate's jumping me from behind. Your final lesson before you leave prison, don't come back. Because that guy beat the hell out of me. And then after that guy beat the hell out of me, the guard come back, opened the door, asked me if I was ready to go. And I'm ready to go. Let's get out of here. So, you know, that right there is a short rundown of what life in prison's like. The kind of people that you meet in prison are the kind of people that you're never going to forget. Like I said, you meet some of the best con artists, you meet some of the best forgerers, you meet people that know how to kill people with their bare hands, you meet some good people, you meet a lot of bad people, you learn that you can live without the outside world, you don't need telephones, you don't need letters, because all those things remind you of an outside world, and you're just trying to pretend that this is all a bad dream. So, you know, if you don't read any letters and if you don't have visitors to talk to, then you never have to worry about these things. The only problem is a great deal of people that go through prison live that way, and then the day they get out of prison, they get handed divorce papers. You know, one more twist of the screw. Or, you know, they get handed notice that they're up on new charges again. Okay, so what happens? All right. They told me, they said that, okay, the conditions of my parole were that I would do 3 years of parole. And the conditions of my parole were that I associated with no known ex-felons. All right? I'm from Oregon. I don't know anybody in California. I'm getting out of prison in California.
So who do I know besides the people I've been in prison with while I'm in California? To get a job, before I get a job, I have to have it approved by my parole officer, which is somebody that I haven't even met yet. All I know is he's got a name. So how do you go to somebody? Okay, say you go up to somebody and you get somebody to say, okay, we'll give you a job, all right? Especially a good paying job, construction or something, where you're gonna start out at $6 to $8 an hour. After a year, that's an awful lot of money. So you, say you do get a job set up, all right? Then what happens? Well, now that you gave me this job, did you call my parole officer and tell him that you hired me? Well, there goes your job right down the tubes. And, or you could go work for a pizza parlor somewhere, in which case they'll probably say, sure, we'll call your parole officer, and then they're going to hold it over your head that, hey, if you don't work 60 hours a week this week, we're going to tell your parole officer you're fired and you'll go back. You know, it's more or less, what did the English used to call them? They used to bring people over from the colonies to the colonies, indentured servants. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's the term I was looking for. You're more or less an indentured servant. I'm not saying that's what always happens, but this is what it sets you up for. And after a year in prison, you're expecting the worst. I mean, you have to accept that attitude that it's going to be the worst, all right? Nothing good is going to happen. Me, I took the easy way out. I split. I hit the outside door. My brother was there. He had my 67 Sportster. He gave me $1,000. And I didn't stop till I hit Washington. I never even bothered to report to my parole officer. I knew I wasn't going to make it. I didn't need anybody to tell me I wasn't going to make it. I split. 4.5 years later, I went back and turned myself in. And at that time, I was given a $4,200 fine, 3 years probation. Taken off parole status and put on probation status, which was a victory in itself. I'm still an ex-felon, which means that I can't vote, even though I'm a veteran and almost died for this country. I can't vote. I can't own a gun. I live in the country. I hunt meat, but I can't own a gun. So, you know, but I mean, I do own guns. I just don't let them know that I do. But I still can't vote. If I get busted for anything else in the rest of my time that I'm alive, at that time I become a second offender, which is what they call being recidivism, which means that you're sinking back into criminality, which means that instead of 1 year, I'll probably get at a minimum of 5 years, especially if it's a crime of violence. Chances are, most likely, it'd probably be 7 to 10 years. Well, let me see, what else was I going to say? Oh yeah, I can't get credit. All the credit that I get, as soon as you go to a bank or something like that and you tell somebody, yeah, you're an ex-felon, there goes your credit rating right down the tube. You can't buy a house, can't buy land, you can't do nothing unless you do, like some people do, get a phony ID and then establish it under phony ID. But then if you get caught with that phony ID, you're going to go back again because that's forgery. So you're kind of like stuck between a rock and a hard spot. So things start building up in your head, and you start thinking, you know, hey, you know, no matter how I'm going to work this, I'm not going to win, all right? So you just have to kind of like take it for granted that there must be a God out there. Couldn't find him in prison, but after 4.5 years being out here on the streets, you can say there has to be a God, or else I'd have never have made it. Because, you know, the funny thing is when I first took off from prison was that I figured that maybe I'd run for 6 or 7 months and they'd catch me. And then I'd just go back. I mean, I'd pretty much set my life to the fact that I was going to spend the rest of my life in prison. After 5 years now, it's one of the least aspects of my life is going back to prison. The memory's still there. After 4.5 years, I figured these guys aren't ever going to catch me. I've got to turn myself in, you know. At that time I was very sick. I thought I was going to die, and I wanted to set things straight with my parents once and for all. Kind of like to be a hero, right? But God wasn't going to let it be that easy. I went down there, I started getting well. And then top it all off, they gave me probation. So, you know, it looks like I'm going to live for a while, so now I have to be an ordinary person. I end up here at Holden Village, you know. And, you know, it's really strange, you know. I mean, it might sound funny while I'm up here talking about it, but 2 years ago, if you told me that I'd be standing here getting along with you people, I would have told you all you were crazy. Because as far as I was concerned, you guys were the criminals, not me, you know, because when you're in prison, the people on the outside are the criminals, all right? The criminals that are behind bars are the honest criminals. You are the dishonest criminals. You hide in your colleges. If you're rich, there's nobody going to tell me that people get rich in the United States legally. Somebody has to break the law along the way. But the only problem is, by the time they get rich, they're too much above it to get busted for it. You know? You can sit around and you can see just how unjust the penal system is by the fact that, okay, look what happened to Nixon, all right? He was behind a burglary and they let him go just because he was the president, all right? Okay, I lost my temper and almost killed a man fighting a war that Nixon was behind. So who's the real criminal, him or me, you know? I can look at it as, okay, well, nothing's perfect. That's my general opinion, is nothing's perfect. The penal system isn't perfect. I'm not perfect. Nixon's scot-free. He'll never get caught. Big deal. It doesn't matter. But the thing about it is there's still people that are in prison. They're trying to cope with the same things that I have. They're not going to have the chances I had. I was pretty lucky in the fact that I had a brother that cared enough for me for the day that I got out of prison to come and give me $1,000 to escape, well, to take a vacation. Because that to me was all it was. It was after a year I was going to take a vacation and then I'd go back to prison again. Which is pretty much what other people feel. Why do people feel that way? Okay, like I said before, people that have been to prison for a while, especially if you've gone back two or three times, okay, you don't want to get out because after you've learned to live with these people, it's very difficult to imagine ever having to live with somebody else. After you've learned that, you know, that, well, it's kind of like people, that, what was that old saying, of those that kill with a gun will live to kill with a gun again. It's kind of like that, you know, especially if you've done something really terrible while you're in prison, like say you raped somebody, or say you killed somebody, or say you killed a guard. It's very hard for you because you still got that sense of guilt. It's very hard for you to imagine the fact that you're going to be able to go back out there on the streets and associate with people. I mean, real honest people. Say for the last 3 or 4 years, you haven't even turned off the light because in prison the lights are on 24 hours a day. You know, you start thinking about little things like that. If you haven't used the telephone in 4 years, there's going to be telephones out there, phone booths. There's going to be people out there. There's going to be cops out there. There's going to be that parole officer out there, you know. A lot of things like that make people pretty tense. And then they got to sit back and they got to think of all the good memories that they had while they were in prison. And then there's the inflation. Minimum house, $75,000. How's the next inmate going to get $75,000 to buy a home? So he says, well, the hell with it. I'll just make this my home. I mean, I've got everything I want in here. I've got 3 meals a day. I got people that know me that aren't going to make fun of me, that aren't going to look down on me. I broke the law. I'm a sinner. I might as well take the opinion of the Hell's Angels of, I know I'll go to heaven because I've done my time in hell. That kind of thing. But, you know, everybody knows that it's phony when you're on the outside. But when you're on the inside, it's about the only way that you can look at life. I mean, it is the only way you can look at life. What you're living through today, okay, it's a day-to-day thing. Okay, say that you live through today. That doesn't mean you're going to live through tomorrow. It doesn't really matter. You learn to cope with the fact very easily that tomorrow you might be a dead man. It gets to the point where after a while it doesn't even bother you. So what happens? You get out, and the major problem with most inmates is that resentment. Because they went, and I've gone through it, and I know what it's like. Like I said, 2 years ago, if you told me I'd going to be up here, the resentment that I had towards somebody that I hadn't even met before would have been enough to just completely turn me off to you, just because of the fact that I did a year in prison, even though I did break the law. Okay, the resentment that I had, I'd have gotten from the institution, just the prison system itself,
the different head trips that I went through while I was in there. And the majority of the people, their resentment will lead them to go to defiance. You know, the defiance of, well, you haven't broke me, brother. I'm going to go out there and break the law again. You can put me behind those bars all you want, but you'll never break me. That's pretty much the attitude the way it is. That's defiance, you know. And it takes an awful lot to me for somebody to go, well, I'll go back for another 10 to 20 years. You can't break me. That's a hard way to prove just how tough you really are, you know. But that's the way people do. I mean, that's the reality that they're living with. It's kind of like, you know, well, if I can't play the game, I'll just take my ball and go home. But it's not, I'm not going to go, I'm going to come back after dinner. This is 10 or 20 years. And they're very serious about it. And they're going to live in hate for the rest of their life. It's going to eat them up. And they're going to keep getting more and more dirty because they just don't care anymore. They've been broken, but they don't even realize it. Everywhere you go, you're going to have a little glass wall between you and everybody else. I still have it after 5 years, the fact that I'm a con and that you're not. It's the same thing as I've got the wall that I'm a veteran. Most of you aren't. You know, it's like that. Things that are impossible to break. Things that make you sometimes walk around at night and look up in the sky and think, you know, is it really worth it? I mean, why am I here? And that's when people like the Lord start to talk to you. Because without the Lord, you can't make it. You can't make that change to the fact that you're ever going to be something normal again. That you can be something that somebody can appreciate, the fact that you can be a good guy. You don't have to be a tough guy. That you can actually be a nice guy. And that's it's a great feeling to after a while discover that you can be a nice guy again. I never thought I could be. I like to think of myself as a nice guy. But at the same time, I realize how tough I can really be if I have to be. But that's bragging, so I won't carry it any further. But that right there is, like I said before, that's the major reason why people are going to go back. It's that defiance of, you're not going to break me. I don't care how many years you put me behind prison, you are not going to break me. You make your own hell, you burn in it. They say that you're agnostic, very agnostic in prison. To me, that's got to be one of the greatest spiritual trips there can be, if you really think about it. You know, the fact that, you know, they're not going to break your individual character because you've got that soul. You know that you're going to burn in your own hell. You're not going to be able to hurt anybody because you're already burning in your hell. So all your sins are forgiven. But if you ask an inmate that behind bars, the one thing he won't cop out to is the fact that he does have a belief in God. And it's really strange, out of all the people that I knew in prison, I think one of the strongest men that I ever met was a Baptist preacher that we had there. And he was in there because supposedly he killed his wife. I never asked him if he killed his wife, so I don't really know. But that man was a true Christian. That man would not put up a hand to defend himself. He didn't have to. Because if somebody went to strike him, there was 200 inmates that would kill whoever tried to strike that man. If you had a problem, he was the only person in the prison that you could go to. The only person that you could go to, that you could say something to, that wasn't going to get around to other people. And he was a no-bullshit person. If you lied to him, he'd tell you that he didn't appreciate you lying to him. He'd pray for your soul, but he wouldn't condone your sins. And for somebody to do that in prison, you have to be one tough person. You have to be a very tough person. Nobody threatened him with rape. Nobody stole from him. He didn't have to. He walked around, you know, he had his own little flock, I guess you could say, of all the inmates in there. I never went to any of his services because I was too busy living up to the role that I was playing of being the tough guy at that time. I imagine he's probably been transferred. He was supposed to go through the chain up to San Quentin. Whether he makes it or not, I'll never know. He was sentenced to life without parole. So he'll never see the outside world again. And you know, for somebody to be sentenced to life without parole, and knowing that he's always going to be behind those bars, and that Santa Rita is just the first step, that he's still got to go to Folsom, and he's still going to go to San Quentin, and yet that guy still believes in God. You know, I mean, that's how strong that guy's faith is.
you know, most of us will probably never meet a person as strong as that man was. I feel good that I knew him for a little while. I never really talked to him as much as I wished I could have. But it was just one of the strangest things because, you know, if you weren't tough, you were a pansy. And pansies just, you know, I saw a lot of people that when they first got there, they came on like they were real Christians, you know. But then it got to the point where you started putting a little bit of pressure on them. And then they started caving in a little bit. The fact that, well, you know, I'm kind of tough and, you know, I'm going to steal. As far as that preacher was concerned, stealing was one of the worst things you could do. He hated snitches. I mean, he hated them. He was right along with us inmates. Nobody likes a snitch and nobody likes a guard. You know, he was right there. The guards, from what I hear, when he first got there, for the first 3 or 4 weeks he was there, they'd take him off for about an hour or two every day and just beat on him just to see how much of a Christian he really was, to see if he'd raise a hand to strike back. And after they realized that all they were going to do is just punch him like a punching bag and that he wasn't going to strike back, they just gave up on him. You know, I mean, that's how powerful that man was. That's what you call being solid, you know.
Can I ask you a question here?
Yes.
I can't, why would he, if he doesn't fight back or wasn't causing any problems, why would he go on up to the maximum security? I mean, you're saying that he's...
Well, okay, when you're sentenced to life without parole, all right, what they usually do is they space out your time span, all right? They say, well, for 15 years, we'll put him here. Then we'll give him a change of pace. We'll put him for 15 years over here. Then we'll give him 15 more years over here. And then he can come back 15 years here, 15 years here, till the day that man dies. You know, now that is hell. You know, he's never going to, there is no hope for parole or something like that. You know, life without parole is life without parole. The only person that can ever exclude him from that would be a presidential pardon, which isn't going to, which, you know, to him, you know, he believes in miracles. And maybe someday God will do that much for him. I really don't know. You know, I hope he does get it. It might sound kind of cold, but sometimes I wish that, you know, somebody would just go up and stick him so that he wouldn't have to live the rest of his life there. You know, somebody would just go ahead and kill him. Because that guy's pretty much suffered enough. I mean, just to adjust yourself to the fact that that's going to be the rest of your life. You know, that right there is a breaking of the soul right there. You know, but you know, it's really strange. Most people, when their souls are broken, they never recover from it. All it ever did to that man was make him 10 times stronger than he ever was. You know? These are the kind of things that you see behind prison walls that most people on the street will never see. I kind of got off my notes here when I got into my talk here. Okay, now the question of rehabilitation, like I said before. Okay, there's a lot of rehabilitation that goes on at prison. I had a way shined on to me here while dinner meal was going on. And this is a place over here at Pike's Peak. You know, everybody says that inmates can't reform themselves. Well, here's a typical idea. Okay, it's called the Con Shop. It's this place down at Pike's Market, Pike's Place. Yeah, in Seattle. A new nonprofit corporation has opened Con Shop Crafts in the Pike Place Market, where you cannot only see but have the opportunity to buy these works of art. Artisans range from members of the Lifers Club. Lifers Club are people that are life without parole. At Walla Walla, to talented first timers, which is what I was, a first timer. All are learning to express themselves through art, learning a valuable craft, obtaining business experience with the money they can buy more supplies, help support their families, or save up a nest egg for when they get out. Come in, browse around. The prices are so low and the quality so high, you may think we are conning you. But because we truly are a nonprofit organization, you don't have to pay the kind of markup you've come to expect for such quality products. Now, you know, you gotta admit, you know, to come on with an attitude like that from behind bars, you gotta be a pretty straightforward person. You know, you gotta realize it, you know. Well, you know, this is where I'm at. And once you've accepted it, life can be a joke again, you know. Then it goes into what they have. We welcome orders for custom-made items, payment on satisfaction only. Now, this is just one of the things that prison the way that inmates are set up to rehabilitate themselves. The Bandidos here in Washington organized all the bikers, which the Bandidos are. They got together and they said, well, we got a bunch of brothers over here in Walla Walla. And they went to the prison authorities and they set it up to the point of where they could take, like, you know, 9 or 10 of these chopped Harley Davidsons that they all worship so much, all right? They could put it behind prison bars, and here's these guys back there doing time on prison. Okay, they got lots of time, so they got time to learn how to take that engine apart and put it back together, all right? They're going to pay for the repairs out of their own pocket just for the privilege of having a Harley Davidson to work on. They can do custom paint jobs and stuff like that, while all the owner does is pay for the cost of the paint. You know, so they're learning something. There's a lot of different ways that they do it. A lot of, like I said at the beginning of the discussion, there's more going on now than ever before to rehabilitate inmates. I don't think it's enough, but, you know, it's still the fact that there is hope. There's primal therapy. Primal therapy directly attacks the inmate as to why he does things. I went through primal therapy while I was in Santa Rita for 6 months. It's what some people call gestalt therapy. It's one of the toughest things to go through. You get attacked from everything that you have. You know, everything that you believe in, anything that you say is going to be attacked. But at the same time, it's a release, which is what I really needed at that time. So what do we have now? Okay, I gave you an idea of a prison system the way I've experienced it. I'm not a talented speaker. I couldn't put up a lot of facts and figures. You know, I had some time here that I wanted to share with everybody to show what prison was like, to kind of give you an idea of what I knew about it, and for people to give me some feedback on it so that I can answer all your questions honestly as I can. All right, I'm not facts and figures. I'm not a computer. Like I said, for 5 years I haven't been in prison, so I'm not really too much up on it right now. But, you know, the main thing is okay, everybody talks about reforming, all right? And this is the main reason why I wanted people here. Okay, like I said in the beginning, it's been, ever since the beginning of man, people have been put in prison. Since the beginning of mankind, people have not been coming out of prison reformed. Prison didn't reform me. 4.5 years of freedom reformed me. Most people aren't ever going to get that chance to get out of prison and get that. So if we can come up with any ideas on that, I'm open to it. Just kind of express something, because, and also one of my hopes is that if you ever experience somebody that's been in prison, you might have an idea of where they stand. And while I'm on that subject, I'd like to bring up the fact that everybody seems to think the people that have been in prison are such tough people. Well, they are tough people. But what most people don't realize is they're running scared, because when they're behind those bars, they got a lot of people to back them up. But out here on the streets, they don't have anybody to back them up, and they can't afford to take a chance on getting a fall. So they might act tough, but that's just to keep you away from them. I think that's something that most people never realize. And all the time I've been out of prison, I've always heard about how tough ex-cons are. Yeah, there's dangerous ex-cons running around, but there's a lot more dangerous people out there running around that have never been behind bars before. And now I'm open for questions.
I don't have a question, but I did a little reading and studying on the Idaho penal system here several years ago. Of course, they've built a new prison since then, but the state of Idaho was a smaller state than California. But the prison they had is not in use now for about 3 or 4 years now. It hasn't been, but the prison they had was, I believe, originally built when during the cavalry days, during the Indian Wars.
Mm-hmm.
The walls are stone, and like you say, 7 feet high, but there, everybody was threw behind the same walls.
Mm-hmm. There was no segregation
of
prisons.
So a lot of people that went in there with minor crimes, who might have had a chance, were thrown in with people who were in California, might have been put down into
CRC or
right down in Vacaville or something. See,
mm-hmm.
So what chance did they have? But by going through and looking at all of this, everything, and then they did something you mentioned, that some of the parole officers in Idaho have been experimenting with, and it's been working pretty good. You go to them and tell them where you've got an availability of a job and keep in contact with, and they never contact that owner. That business.
It's up to the inmate to contact the business.
The inmate makes no mention to him that he's an ex-con.
Uh-huh. Oh, then what you're saying is they allowed it for an inmate to get a job without telling...
They allow the guy on parole, they allow him to get a job, and he's out on parole, depending on the crime, like in California, if it's a crime of nonviolence, maybe you might be a year on parole. Of course, you've always got the total amount of time that you haven't spent behind the wall. You've always got that total amount of time still hanging possibly, potentially, over your head. But then in crimes of violence, you might be out 4 or 5 years under parole or something. But what they'll do is they'll give you the opportunity to go to the city and the state that you're going to and attain your own job without putting out that you're an ex-con. And then see if you can make it.
Mm-hmm.
Because of, like you said, see, if you got yourself a good job, but then right away, because of the conditions of your parole, you have to tell them, or your parole officer tells them, and you lose it. So they saw where this was playing an important part of sending parolees back to prison, because they didn't give them the chance.
Mm-hmm. Got their throat cut before they can cut it
themselves. I think you've probably also seen, from what I read and everything, I think when you've also seen, heaven help the guy that fouls up that system,
mm-hmm,
and goes back, because he's taking a chance of fouling it up for the next man in there that's waiting to get out on the same system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of like based on the system that the Seventh Step program had for a long time, only it was allowing for the inmates and outside help to get them a job. They've got organizations called Friends Outside that do the same thing. But, you know, like you say, what you're talking about, where you don't have to put out the fact that you're an ex-felon, whereas Seventh Step and Friends Outside puts it right up front that, hey, we got a guy that we can get him out of prison right now if you give him a job, you know. And not very many employers can back down. They go to all the steel companies, any place where they're going to need somebody big, you know. They go to steel companies, they go to wood companies, you know. But the only problem is, you know, after you've worked in a certain area for so long, all the jobs are filled up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's a constantly shifting thing. What works for 2 or 3 years might not work 3 or 4 years after that. You know, one of the major problems I think with most prison systems is the fact that they can't keep interest going in them long enough. You know, because there is one point that I won't deny. You know, people that go behind those bars did break the law. You know, they did break the law. They do have to be punished. All right. We know that our system isn't fair, but we also know that our system is the best. And when you look at all the other foreign countries, we have the best legal system. No, it isn't perfect, but people just kind of assume, well, since I'm never going to get involved in it, why really worry about it, okay? Well, the thing about it is it's coming to the point in time where, okay, prison is getting to be the point of where you cannot survive at all. It's being divided. There's racial division. There's the Black Muslim Party. And the Black Muslims Party is blacks that feel that the only good white man is one that's dead. Nine dead white men got you a free trip to heaven. Then you have your American Nazi Party that if it ain't white, it ain't right, and it's got to die. They're very serious people. The SLA, they came from San Quentin, and they managed to make it from San Quentin out into the streets, all right? These are the kind of things that are coming up in prison because of the fact that there isn't enough reform going on, you know? I'm not pointing a finger at anybody in here and saying it's your fault, you know? All I'm trying to do is put the word out that, you know, that there's changes needed. If you ever run across a time when you can do changes, help, you know, write a letter to your congressman, get involved with Friends Outside, the Seventh Step program. Most of all, if you ever come in contact with an inmate, you might have an idea of where he's been. Not all inmates are like me, you know. Most people upon first meeting me wouldn't know I was an ex-con. Yes?
Yeah, did you hear that they had a special on television about Scared Straight?
Oh yeah, what they're doing with juveniles?
Yeah.
Yeah, that works great with juveniles, but what do you do with adults, and especially with a second time offender?
Yeah, I was wondering, what do you think, you know, having been in jail for a year, and it's 4 or 5 years afterwards, and of course, you
studied the system, you've been in the system, what would you think would have been the best way? Now, you did commit a crime. Now, looking back on it, if you were to handle yourself, mm-hmm. to help yourself, what would you do, you think?
What would I do? You know, I've gone over that a million times in my mind, and it's probably got to be one of the hardest things that I've ever looked at. I think before you send anybody to a prison, anybody, I don't care who it is, he should go through intense psychiatric counseling. Like I said, I was 2 years out of the Vietnam War when I went to prison, all right? I won't blame Vietnam for all my problems. I don't think I would have tried to kill that guy if it wasn't for the war. I don't think that going to prison stopped any urges that I might have of ever killing somebody again, you know? What would I have done? I'd like to think of myself as somebody that needed to go to a psychiatric hospital first and then to a prison. At least give me a chance to know why I did those things before I go behind bars. And I think that'd probably be one help. I think prevention is the greatest thing, like this, what was this you were just saying about scared straight? I think that's one of the greatest things for juveniles. For adults, I think that the law that they're laying down now, that if you commit a crime with a gun, you're going to go behind bars. I think that's the greatest thing there is, because until they start doing that, people aren't really going to realize it. I think that isolation should be eliminated from prisons. I think people that in prison should have more access to psychiatric systems. I think the snitch system should be completely eliminated and arrange for an inmate council and give the inmates a chance to rule themselves. That's how this con thing got started, this con shop. Yes?
You can't eliminate that snitch thing with the caliber of guards, though, that they're hiring for the prisons. When I did this reading and stuff on this system in Idaho, I got interested because I had a good friend of mine mm-hmm. that got sent to Idaho for double murder, mm-hmm. His wife and his mother-in-law. He got out, and there was nothing wrong with the man except the pressures that had been put on him that the courts didn't bother fully looking into before they sentenced him. Mm-hmm. There was no psychiatric thing. And of course, when you went behind the walls there, well, like he said to him, the average guard in a prison, it's his last chance of making it before he actually gets behind the walls himself.
Yeah.
Because he just has no intelligence to hold anything else, and it's his last chance, or else he's just a thin line.
It's like I said, he only has to have eighth grade education to get that job.
And you've got a man like that that's is in most cases better than the man behind the walls, then how are you going to get this help recognized and see that it gets to the inmates?
Well, you know, the thing about it is okay, if you can establish an inmate council, all right, and say you got, okay, like one of the people that was there, the Silver Fox, say the Fox is getting ready to crack under the pressure from being behind those bars too long, all right? Somebody can go to the inmate council and say, hey, man, this guy's getting ready to crack. All right, these are solid inmates that I'm talking about. All right, people that have nothing to lose, but people that are going to be in there for life imprisonment or something. Those would be the members of the inmate council. All right, something that they can go to and say, hey, man, this guy's getting ready to crack. That guy's an inmate. He's going to know why that guy's getting ready to crack. All right, he can sit there and say, well, hey, you know, we'll get a psychiatrist to him, and maybe they can save part of that man's mind before it goes. You know. Four-yard Jack, I remember the day he cracked. The day he cracked, he killed three guards. You know, but, I mean, like, you could see him building up to it 3 months before it happened. You know.
Well, how does the segregation work in the prisons in California, though?
Well, segregation...
Do they, between minimum, I mean, between minimum and medium, say,
mm-hmm.
Do they keep those inmates apart?
Yeah, minimum and medium. Okay, Santa Rita, where am I? Razor Grove. Well, anyways, Santa Rita was set up like this. Okay, right here, you had what was called the Little Graystone, all right? The Little Graystone was minimum security. Then you had administration right here. It was both this right here was a one-story, and you had a courtyard here, you had little farming areas, and
a laundry, a lot of things for people to do, and you had your barrack areas and a big old cafeteria. Then you had administration, which was on the first floor. Then you had medium security right here, right up above it. Below administration was isolation. And then here was your medium, and then right up above that was Murder Max.
And medium, you say, was actually better than minimum.
Yes, because, you know, the one thing that you get to hate when you're behind bars is the fact that somebody's always in your space. You'd never have no privacy. So you get up here where you only got to put up with 3 or 4 people most of the time. That's a lot better than 300 or 400.
Would people in minimum security deliberately do something just to get put in maximum?
I did.
You did, yeah.
Well, the reason what I'm building up to, though, about this, although as bad as California's system is, and you're trying to relate to that, you know, to find answers to help the people when they get out or when they're in there. But as bad as that system is, from what I've read about the state of Idaho, can you imagine what it would be like under their system where everybody is thrown into one big jungle? Everybody's behind one wall. The only people that are locked up are those in on death row, or somebody put into a death row cell, which is the same building, say, for protected custody, to protect them from the inmates of the yard.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, everybody's thrown into the same jungle.
It would be a madhouse.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying that their system is wrong. You know, I mean, it's a good thing that San Quentin is where the most of the lifers are at. I mean, it's, you know, that's where they're happy. They don't want to be with the rest of those people. Like I said before, you know, you don't want to get to know somebody that's only going to be there for 4 or 5 years, you know, if you're going to be there for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
So most of them are very happy right there.
Do you think you should even have more division like where you were? I mean, there was a lot of different types of people with, you know, for different reasons. Would it have been better? Well, like, first of all, you felt like you should have talked to a psychiatrist and so forth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine going in there and kind of seeing a lot of these other people. And you had some problems of your own, and now you've got all kinds of other problems to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be better to have more division, you think?
That's what I was trying to build up to.
Well,
I
think that
more than they, have.
Right.
They need to give people more space. If they're going to put people in prison, at least give them enough space to where they can think. Just a second, okay? Give them more recreation, all right? People do not know freedom when they're put into an institution where they cannot think. You know, you put somebody in a place where they can't think, they're never going to know freedom again. You put a leash on them that they're never going to break loose from. And that's what most of them are going through. You have to give those inmates a little bit of slack. But it's kind of like under the thing of, well, if you blow it, you only blow it once. All right? That might sound kind of cold, but I think it would get a lot more accomplished. You know, it would get finally good, all the people that want to end up at San Quentin. Because some people, that's a big hero thing. You know, well, I've been up at the queue. You know, well, big deal. It doesn't matter where you've been. You've still been behind bars. You know, although if somebody told me they'd been behind the queue, I probably would watch them a little bit more than if I knew that they weren't. You know, but I mean, that's space, and then you wouldn't necessarily have to be subdivision. Okay, everybody says, why build more prisons? Okay, well, it's kind of obvious that we haven't stopped crime in our time, that we're not going to. Every year it goes up, all right? We know we're going to need the space. We don't have a prison anywhere in the United States that's not suffering from overcrowding right now, all right? Undoubtedly, our system isn't going to work, so it's time to look at it again and try one more time, you know?
It seems like we're going off and look at it again. I mean, that seems like it's the point, is to give our attention to it and put more money into it or whatever else. I mean, it's just like on the side of society for most of us.
Well, it's like a ghetto. You'd never know it was there.
Yeah.
Can I come back to you?
Yeah. A couple things. One thing, you know, we talk about further division. I wondered about your idea of that. Probably, well, my guess would be that there are people that are locked up that maybe wouldn't have to be locked up, that there are maybe other things besides just, you know, locking someone up. I mean, when we talk about other options, like more divisions, maybe some of those divisions would be not to lock somebody up,
mm-hmm.
but to impose some other kinds of control, whatever it may be. I mean, that's another way of making some other distinctions between people, and that maybe would removes the necessity of building more actual prisons. I'd like to hear.
Okay.
But then let me put another question that goes with that. I think your presentation is indicating to me is your own opinion that sometimes prison could might be more or less of a right thing for or the correct punishment, or I'm not quite sure how to.
No, what I'm saying is I don't know how to rehabilitate somebody that's been behind bars for 15 or 20 years.
Right.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
You know, I wish I did. Mm-hmm. You know, I was kind of hoping maybe somebody else could come up with something. Yeah. You know, that was my original intention. I'm glad to clarify that. Yes.
Well, I think that some of the prison administrators throughout the country, I believe, have some ideas that they would like to try, but the public, as a general, won't accept them. And I think Washington State's an example. Washington State was wanting to go to some mini prison systems and more honor bar.
Yeah, I think so.
Which gets you out more into a dormitory type living type thing to kind of get you back into gear. But the public won't accept it.
So
I think the answer is, I think a lot of the ideas are there, but I think what's going to be done first is to figure out a way to convince the public that, hey, we're not going to throw a bunch of maniacs out on you and get them to accept it. Then I think there are a lot of ideas that work.
Oh, yeah, it's very common, like just the fact of where they try to take mentally retarded people out of state mental institutions and put them in houses in cities. Have you ever read in the paper where they cause a big stink?
Mm-hmm.
You know, these people are mentally retarded. They've never hurt somebody in their whole life.
Right.
You know, but the whole neighborhood gets upset because these people have been in an institution.
Right.
And also, I think the biggest thing that's crippling the penal system in any state is going back to what I said about the parole board. Nobody on a parole board deals with things on a personal level. You know, and until you deal, and that's what freedom's all about, right? Being personal. I mean, to me it is. And I think that to a lot of other people it is too. As long as you're going to treat somebody like they're just a number, that's all they're ever going to be. It goes right back to what I said. If you can't think, you can't think freedom.
Well, who are these parole officers?
A parole officer is a man that's got 45 to 50 hours a week to handle about 135 people.
What type of person is he, though?
I have a probation officer. I never really had very much time to talk to my parole officer.
Yeah.
Most of the parole officers I've ever met were, I'd say, probably all your gentlemen's ages, maybe a little younger, between the ages of 25 to 45. A good deal of them are retiring. You meet very few of them that are in their mid-20s. Most of them have majored in sociology in college and have gotten a master's or a bachelor of arts. All it takes is a bachelor of arts to become in sociology to become a parole officer. Probation officer takes, I forget what it is, it's a different kind of thing. So here's a guy that's got to handle 135 different people each week. Each week it's going to be a different 135 people. You know, that gives you about 2 minutes a week with that guy. You know, so it's kind of like, okay, so what has the parole officer really got to go by? The parole officer, all he's got is, okay, if he feels that you're violating your parole, he can do a lot of things. He can just drop in where you're working at any time. Come in, see who you're hanging around with. Come up to your house at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, walk on in, see if you're smoking dope, who you're there with. If you're having sex and you're not married, you can get violated for that. Say an unmarked cop car is driving down the street and sees you talking to one of your buddies at the joint. He knows that you've been in the joint. He knows that guy's been in the joint. He knows who your parole officer is. So he just goes over and he says, yeah, I've seen that guy talking to a no-next felon. All right? At which point, you have automatically violated your parole. All right? As far as, at that point, you don't have the original thing of when you originally go to court of being innocent until proven guilty. At that point, you're guilty until proven innocent. When you violate your parole...
Most parole officers are I mean, I get the feeling that you feel that, in fact, I think I've kind of read this somewhere too, that most generally ex-convicts feel that the parole officer is really the enemy. Do any of these parole officers try to...
I think most of them would like to, but they're like what I said back in the beginning, of everybody gets ground down in the prison system. Mm-hmm. You know, they just get so swamped. You know, your prisons are overloaded. Your caseloads are overloaded. After 15 or 20 years, you can't help but be a little bit bitter. And, you know, you see so many people going back, you just after a while have to assume that, well, we'll go ahead and send him back. Just like that, one after another. Just if nothing else, to cut down your paperwork. Because you don't have the time to sit down and really get to know those people. You know, and deal with them on a one-to-one level.
Of course, here again, you know, from his standpoint, I imagine that if he takes a number of chances, and
oh, yeah,
has a bad record, here again, he's going to lose his job.
Oh, yeah, and I imagine over the years he's been lied to more times than any of us ever will, you know. So he has no choice but to automatically assume that somebody's lying to him. I can see where he's at. You know, I don't hate parole officers. I see where they're at, you know. I don't hate cops. I see where they're at. I don't hate guards, even though I think I have every reason to. You know, I don't like them, but I don't hate them. I think that's the general feeling that most people have with parole officers. It's like I said, you have that invisible wall that drops behind you, you know. Yes?
Now, you said that, you know, you hoped that someone would come up with a way, and you thought that you didn't have a way. But I think your statement about how 4.5 years of freedom was what, you know, did for you when you were in prison, that makes an awful lot of sense to me. And I think that, for instance, the idea of counsel might be a way, simply because you're talking about, among other things, you're talking about responsibility. I mean, responsibility is a personal thing, too. And you're talking about some people beginning to have some responsibility for themselves, which would be an aspect of freedom. And perhaps, very likely, given prisons and not expecting them to disappear tomorrow, there have to be some ways to help people to be free. I read one book. I don't know, you may or may not have respect for the book, but it was a good experience for me, not really knowing anything, but just accepting the book at face value, and that was Autobiography of Malcolm X.
He got shot down at San Quentin.
Huh?
Wasn't he shot down at San Quentin?
No. He got out of prison. He went in, I don't know, he was in for violent crime.
Three time loser?
Yeah, I don't know. He got out. I don't remember that part. But what happened was, a change happened to him while he was in prison. Some kind of a change similar to the change that you've experienced since then happened to him while he was still there. Part of it was that he began to believe in God while he was in prison in an upfront way, but it was black Muslim kind of a thing at first.
Mm-hmm.
And had a lot of, there was a lot of stuff that he originally believed that later on he let go as he saw that it was a function of life in prison more than it was a reflection of a larger picture of, you know, the world. But what it was a way for him to get some kind of freedom while he was in prison so that he could begin to be a person. And given that, he became, you know, he got some of these kind of qualities of strength that this other man had that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
He had some integrity and some recognition from other people, and all those things that go into being a person began to happen for him. And the picture you've given is one of how very difficult, almost impossible, you know, that is. And yet that's what's needed. So I think you are onto something, but how to crack into that, you know, that's tough.
Yes.
I agree with him. I think you're onto something, and what I'm going to say maybe you won't agree with, but this is what I'm gathering from this.
Mm-hmm.
To begin with, you're put in prison for a crime, and you're accepting this.
Mm-hmm.
You did something, so you're going to spend your time for it. That's what this prison is for the punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be more acceptable and safe in your own case, knowing that when you got paroled, that this parole officer was going to be a person who did have time, who did and we were going to, and you come out with the impression, okay, I'm going to report to him. Nobody else knows it. They're going to let me report to him, but they're going to let me prove that I'm my own man, I can make it.
If I could have had a chance like that, I never would have run.
So maybe what we need then is a system, something like I think I said they were experimenting in Idaho with some of the parole system there, or the parole office. But we need to get the public more willing to allot the funds to increase the parole officer staff. Mm-hmm. Where his workload isn't such that, you know, you can't spend much time with an ex-con on parole at 2 minutes of your time.
I think a lot of that would go back into what I was saying about prevention.
The parole officer should be talking to you before you get out. In your case, you didn't know who he was or not.
No, I'd never met him. I didn't meet him until after I turned myself in 4.5 years later.
Huh. Yeah. It just seems like common sense that you would talk to the parole officer before they released you, I would think.
No, they had a representative from the parole officer, Cub. He gave me a form of all these rules and regulations that I had to have, and I signed it, and he was gone. That was the closest association I had, and one of the rules of my parole was that I was to report to my parole officer within 5 hours of my release. Within 5 hours of my release, I was into Oregon on my way to Washington. You know, and I was straight up Interstate 5 the whole way. I wasn't going to stop.
Well, the true parole system that properly handled would have probably done the same thing for you in a year's parole that you spent 4.5 years worrying about but accomplished.
Right. I think it might have, you know, very good chance of it. You know, if I could have had a chance to work with somebody, you know, and just...
Because, you know, you said yourself, you know, no matter what, you know, you were tough and such, but yet, no matter what kind of a shell you put outside, if you have to go to somebody and apply for a job, and after you really sold yourself, and they say, now, hey, I'm just released, I'm on parole, this type of thing is going to destroy a lot for you, where if you'd have known I can make it on my own merits, you'd have probably stuck it for a year.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's like during the 4.5 years that I ran, I got a number of different phony IDs at the time, and after a while it just became a habit that everywhere I went, nobody knew what my real name was. You know, I had the name Doc tattooed on the back of my hand, and that was a very easy name. People would ask me, what's your name? Doc. Well, what's your real name? What's it to you? You know, like that. You know, people have a tendency to stay away from me. But, you know, it's strange. You know, you really learn how to live with loneliness doing that. So in some ways, you're not really rehabilitating yourself. You're just learning how to live without somebody, which isn't really rehabilitation. Rehabilitation is learning to get out there and deal with society. If they'd really looked at that when I went in and turned myself in that perspective, I might have ended up going back to prison. You know, they didn't, which I consider to be lucky. I consider it a miracle of the Lord. Going back to jail after 4.5 years was an experience in itself. Because when I went back to jail, I didn't go back as a tough guy. I didn't go back as an ex-felon. This time I went back as a Christian. And one of the people I was in jail with while I was getting all this thing switched around was one of the people that had been in Santa Rita with me. And he saw the difference, the changes I'd been through. And I got put through the challenge then. You know, the guards gave me a hard time while I was in there. I got threatened. But I stuck with my Christian principles. And after 6 days, I was out. You know, I was out, and then all I had to do was go to court and tell them how I felt, you know, and it was great. I mean, it worked, you know, but it worked for me, you know, and I only wish that it could work for so many other people. But, you know, but that 4.5 years that I was on the run, I wasn't always legal, okay, because for one thing, I had to break the law to go on the run. I can make it sound like a hero, you know, the last of the outlaws, whatever, but the thing about it was I broke the law. I had to break the law to get myself straightened out with the law. Two wrongs did not make a right. You know, I beat the court at its own game because a court is balanced on facts. If they'd taken the facts in that perspective that two wrongs do not make a right, I wouldn't be here right now. I'd most likely be sitting back in Santa Rita right now.